This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, February 12, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as President Obama addresses the nation in his State of the Union, immigrant rights and LGBT activists push for protections against deportations. Amid an increase of U.S. military power in Asia, North Korea conducts a nuclear test. And we'll go to the Philippines, where hundreds of thousands of people displaced by a massive storm in December still cannot go home.
All the electricity were out, no water. It was run over by a big tree.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Police in Papua New Guinea say they have arrested suspects related to last week's mob torture and murder of a 20-year-old mother accused of sorcery. All told, officials expect 50 arrests connected to the attack in which a crowd stripped Kapari Leniata, tortured her with a hot rod, and then burned her alive atop a pile of tires and trash. United Nations spokesperson Cecile Puy says allegations of witchcraft are commonly used to deprive women of land and property in the country, and that these brutal assaults are growing.
The government really needs to demonstrate its political will in addressing this very disturbing issue. And this can be done through providing education, but as well providing protection for people who are accused of sorcery and witnesses of sorcery-related killings. Another aspect would be to provide medical and psychosocial treatment for victims of sorcery assaults.
A reform commission in Papua New Guinea has called for the repeal of the country's 1971 Sorcery Act, under which those convicted of committing an act of sorcery face up to 8 years in jail. Human rights advocates are urging the government to take final action. At least 12 people are dead today and many injured after police fired on angry protesters at a polling station in India's Assam state. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports.
A curfew is in place and military forces deployed after violence broke out during disputed local elections. Police opened fire when hundreds of people armed with iron rods, axes, machetes and sticks attacked polling stations in the Goalpara district of Assam. Locals opposed the election, saying it undermines their independence. The resource-rich state is often affected by communal violence. The state police chief says officers opened fire after coming under attack. After the shooting, the crowd rampaged, burning buses and security vehicles. Assam's chief minister announced $10,000 in compensation for the next of kin of those killed, $1,000 to those injured. The opposition Assam Gan Parishad blamed the violence on the ruling Congress for pushing the contentious elections forward. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata, India.
The ACLU has sued the administration of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker regarding what it says are unconstitutional restrictions on free speech at the state capitol. Molly Stentz reports from Madison.
It's been 2 years since Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker first introduced a bill to gut public unions in the state. And while the mass demonstrations have died down, some protesters continue a daily vigil at the Capitol. Dozens have been ticketed, and some have been arrested and held at the county jail. But a new lawsuit is challenging the Capitol Police's right to single out participants in a daily event called the Solidarity Sing-Along. The lawsuit was brought by the ACLU of Wisconsin on behalf of Michael Kissick, a University of Wisconsin professor.
It's my perspective that this country began out of political dissent. This is political speech. This should be the most protected speech.
The lawsuit seeks to halt the new capital access rules implemented by the state last year, which protesters say prompted the ticketing. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
After days of debate, the French Assembly advanced a law legalizing gay marriage and adoption today. The Marriage for All bill goes next to the country's Senate, where it's expected to pass. Already supported by French President François Hollande, the bill would go into effect as early as this May. Human Rights Watch issued a report today alleging Israel committed apparent violations of the laws of war during attacks on Gaza in November 2012. The report cited 18 attacks, many launched by drones, in which at least 43 civilians were killed, 12 of them kids. The investigation found that the attacks were conducted without apparent legal justification. No clear military objective, no attempt to distinguish combatants from civilians. The attack with the highest civilian death toll struck the home of Jamal al-Dalu.
Everything, all of the money, the house, that was lost. I'll forgive God, but my children, my grandchildren, my wife, my life partner, I had a good life. They took it from me. Why? Why?
The report does acknowledge indiscriminate rocket fire by Palestinian fighters. The Israeli military says it is conducting an operational debriefing with results due in late February. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. As President Obama addresses the nation in his State of the Union, two groups are pressuring the administration for action: immigrant rights and LGBT equality activists. One issue that touches both groups may soon come up for debate in Congress: whether U.S. citizens will be able to sponsor their same-sex partners under the developing immigration reform law. Activists say that despite promises of prosecutorial discretion from the Obama administration last year, LGBT undocumented people continue to face deportation. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, bans the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages and giving those couples the same legal rights and benefits as opposite-sex couples, including tax breaks, shared child custody, and health care. This affects countless couples across the country, including those in which one partner is not a U.S. citizen. Last September, the Department of Homeland Security announced they'd consider same-sex and opposite-sex relationships equally when deciding whether to put someone in deportation proceedings. But Felipe Sousa Rodriguez, with the LGBT rights group Get Equal, says this policy, much like the prosecutorial discretion the president promised for young undocumented students, hasn't stopped them from being deported. And when LGBT immigrants are put in detention, Rodriguez says they often face sexual assault and violence, and are frequently deported to countries that persecute people based on sexual orientation.
Imagine, a U.S. citizen who lives in the U.S., has a spouse in Uganda or Iran or several countries in Latin America. They have to live with the fact that their spouse could be killed at any point.
Some lawmakers are working to change this situation. Last week, New York Democrat Jerry Nadler introduced the Uniting American Families Act, a bill that would enable LGBT couples to sponsor their partners for a green card. Nadler's guest for the State of the Union address is Maryland native Kelly Costello, an LGBT rights activist whose Peruvian wife is at risk of deportation. Human rights advocates are pushing for similar measures in the Senate, where lawmakers are currently crafting an immigration reform bill that will be unveiled in the coming weeks. Arizona's John McCain and several other Republicans have expressed opposition to granting binational LGBT couples equal rights, calling it a red herring that would derail the debate. But several Democrats, including New Hampshire's Jean Shaheen, say they'll be pushing for a provision similar to the Uniting American Families Act.
I think it's important not just for my constituents, but for people across the country who deserve the same access to equal rights and opportunities that all other Americans have. And as we're looking at how can we better integrate and address those people who have been here illegally, it seems to me that this is one of the issues that we need to be addressing.
Four undocumented activists will join lawmakers in the House chamber for Tuesday's State of the Union. The so-called Dreamers, Julieta Garibay, Alan Ailman, Amber Pinto, and Gabino Sanchez, were brought to the U.S. as children and are now pushing for Congress to pass a bill that grants them a path to citizenship. Fellow Dreamer Erica Andiola, who qualified for 2 years of protection from deportation under the Obama administration's policies and now works for House Democrat Kristen Sinema, is watching the speech from Arizona. A longtime immigrant rights activist, Andiola, made national headlines last month after her mother and older brother were detained by immigration officers during a raid of their home. They were released when people across the country, including members of Congress, spoke out.
I'm hoping that this is not something that is just going to happen with me, but that we can actually do this for the rest of the 11 million folks that are here. You know, many of them go through this every single day of their lives. You know, there's rates every day of houses across the country that needs to stop as well. And I'm hoping that this year is going to be the year to make that happen.
As the GOP seeks to improve its popularity among voters of color, Florida Senator Marco Rubio has been tapped to deliver the official Republican rebuttal to President Obama's address. Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, who supports temporary visas but not citizenship for Dreamers, will then give the Tea Party's response. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today, North Korea said it carried out a nuclear test underground in the northern part of the country, drawing condemnation from its regional neighbors, including China and the international community. Kim Sung-hwan of the Republic of Korea spoke on behalf of the UN Security Council after an emergency meeting this morning in New York.
The members of the Security Council strongly condemned this test, which is a grave violation of Security Council Resolution 1718 in 2006, 1874 in 2009, and 2087 in 2013, and therefore there continues to exist a clear threat to international peace and security.
Kim said the Security Council would begin talks immediately on a resolution to respond to the nuclear test. The Security Council has previously passed several resolutions tightening sanctions against North Korea, including one in January. The World Food Program estimated in November 2012 that nearly 3 million North Koreans, or 1 in 10, face undernutrition and food shortages. The nuclear test also comes as the U.S. has increased its military presence in the region. A joint exercise with South Korea last week included a U.S. nuclear submarine. For more, we're joined by Christine An, board member of the Korean Policy Institute and member of the National Campaign to End the Korean War. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi, Dorian.
Now, according to the official news service from North Korea, it said the government used a miniaturized and lighter nuclear device with greater explosive force than in the past. The U.S. Geological Survey said today's seismic activity had been a magnitude of 4.9. Why now? What's the context for this?
First of all, it's important to note that North Korea, which is, you know, highly portrayed in the media as a very belligerent and rational actor, is actually very deliberate and very calculating. And there are a few factors that are at play. For one, North Korea conducted its past two nuclear tests following UN Security Council sanctions against its country. Secondly, there is an incoming president in South Korea, Park Geun-hye. She's the first South Korean female president, the daughter of the former dictator, Park Chung-hee. And she's of the same party of the current administration, the New Frontier Party of Lee Myung-bak, who has been a very hardline president against North Korea. I think North Korea is sending a very strong message to South Korea that it should consider changing its hardline approach, which essentially cut off all humanitarian aid, dialogue, and ratchet up military exercises against North Korea.
The Obama administration has identified a shift in military policy toward Asia, calling it a pivot towards Asia. And on February 4th, the U.S. began joint military exercises with South Korea. How does that factor into this?
These involved, you know, several dozens of thousands of soldiers. It involves, like, highly sophisticated machinery, warfare, technology. It's all simulating an invasion of North Korea. So North Korea is feeling cornered, and so it feels it has to flex its military might. And so the only thing that it really has to do that, unfortunately, is a nuclear weapon.
What about China? China had issued advice to North Korea not to go forward with such a test as recently as in the last few weeks. What has their response been like, and how significant is that?
China has, I think, sided with North Korea, not just because of its historic alliance. I mean, China was the nation that did enter the Korean War and sided with North Korea to push back U.S. essential domination over the Korean Peninsula. But, you know, it has always seen North Korea as a buffer against further U.S. Military encroachment along its borders. And so, fortunately, Korea is being used as a pawn, I think, in this war between, you know, increasing militarization and hostility between the U.S. and China.
Christine, on today, the U.N. Security Council said it is working on a new resolution in response. As we heard a moment ago, the council said it views this latest test as a violation of previous resolutions. Talk about sanctions on North Korea and the effects those have had on the country, since a new resolution could include more sanctions or tightening of sanctions.
So I think this is a very important point, Dorian. We often look at images of North Korea, whether it's people that are facing persistent food shortages or, you know, the country often, you know, viewed at night, there isn't, you know, there's a black hole. If you look at satellite images, there's lights all around South Korea, China, Japan, but there's this black hole in North Korea. Well, it's energy crisis, it's food crisis. It's all tied to these economic sanctions, which have been in place for the last 60 years. Led by the United States, the superpower. It was not, so the sanctions were not that intense because of the situation when there was a former socialist trading bloc. But now that that socialist bloc no longer exists for the last 20 plus years, you know, it has been contending with a world order that has been led by the United States. And so it has been sort of recalibrating and surviving because of the rise of the Chinese economy. But it is still in dire straits. And, you know, these sanctions are not helping North Korea join the international community. It is further isolating them. And so we have to understand that its human rights crisis, which include its food crisis, include its inability to access medicine or electricity to heat their homes, these are all tied up with an unended Korean War.
Christine An is a board member of the Korea Policy Institute and member of the National Campaign to End the Korean War. She joined us to discuss responses to today's nuclear test in North Korea. Christine An, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dorian.
In Buenos Aires, a group of artists is occupying a city-owned theater called the Sala Alberdi. They offer free performances and art workshops to the public, but are now fighting the city's effort to shut down the public space. The occupation is continuing despite a judicial order issued last week to leave. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill has more.
There's a theater on Sarmiento Street in downtown Buenos Aires that's been occupied, the protesters sing. That's because Mayor Mauricio Macri wants to privatize it, they add. Two and a half years ago, the city threatened to close the theater in order to move it to another location, but that location never materialized. In response, a group of artists took over the space and continued to offer free cultural events. Leila, who like many involved in the occupation, refuses to give her last name for fear of retaliation, started coming here 9 months ago to attend performances and theater and dance workshops.
Without realizing it, suddenly I was sweeping and helping out. And I learned what self-management is, because no one came to sweep. No one came to set up the microphones and everything.
In January, the city of Buenos Aires closed the building in which the Sala Alberdi is located. In response, a handful of artists broke into and occupied the space. A larger group, which calls itself the Cultural Camp, is living in tents on the patio next to the cultural center. Wilan, who says she's an actress, a clown, and an artist, as well as a college student, helps organize the camp's ongoing cultural events.
From the beginning, art was our way to fight. They closed the doors on us. They use violence against the people that want to access the public space, and we always respond with art. We start our marches with art. We do variety shows, performances.
Currently, unmarked security guards are blocking the doors in the cultural center so that those inside the Sala Alberdi have no access to bathrooms, food, or water. Instead, camp participants send food through the window of a seventh-story room. Hernán Lombardi, the Minister of Culture of the City of Buenos Aires, has told newspapers that the situation is a nightmare and that a handful of protesters are occupying a space that should be for everyone. Leila disagrees with Lombardi's interpretation.
La toma es una forma de
protest. The occupation is a form of protest, and if they don't talk to us, clearly we are going to stay in the space until it occurs to them to speak with us and try to find a solution. If they turn deaf ears, well, we'll stay here, and we'll do what we do, which is give workshops, screenings, talks, and performances by donation only.
The protesters plan to continue their occupation until the government reopens the cultural center. They've also scheduled a march on Friday through downtown Buenos Aires.
La sala al verde está aguantando
sin subsidio, sin patrón, con toma y autogestión y cuando quiera.
Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Tomaremos el color.
2 months after Typhoon Bopha, people in the southern Philippines continue to struggle. The United Nations said it was 2012's deadliest storm, with more than 1,000 killed, hundreds of thousands displaced, and massive destruction to houses, infrastructure, and farms. FSRN's Madonna Varola traveled to the badly battered province of Compostela Valley and brings us this update.
Traveling on a public bus from Davao City, I passed through Monte Vista town. Communities that once stood on nearby riverbeds are now gone. Typhoon Bopha wiped them out. Hundreds of houses are destroyed. The remaining roofs are twisted. Countless coconut and banana trees are uprooted or chopped off. Oil palms are felled along roadsides. At Moncayo Municipality, there's a disaster operations tent which is staffed by employees and volunteers. High school teacher Maylene Cuesta is here seeking assistance. She lost sight in her left eye from the typhoon.
Actually, both eye po yung tinamaan ng GI shift yung...
When the typhoon hit our community at dawn time, it brought harsh winds, so we scampered for safe shelter as we feared a landslide. Thousands of houses were wiped out. I was holding my one-year-old baby who kept crying. I even breastfed him. Before I lost consciousness on the ground, galvanized iron sheets hit my eyes, which caused heavy bleeding. My husband and neighbors carried me, crossed huge rivers, crawled on bridges, and ran for miles. It was 12 midnight when we reached a hospital.
Doctor's hospital, around 12 midnight na siya.
Another survivor from Union Village is 70-year-old Sulpicio Balawag.
We lost our farm, our livelihood. I was carried away by the rush of waters. Logs hit me. I drowned. I was rescued by companions. The following day, they brought me to the hospital in the next town, where I stayed for 6 days.
Nearby, the government's gymnasium was turned into an evacuation center. The center is filled with more than 300 survivors from Typhoon Bopha, also called Pablo. Rooms have been improvised out of cloth and wood. It's early afternoon and some are cooking food while children are playing. A group of service providers from International Organization for Migration is talking with some of the women. Christy Marfil is their senior operations assistant.
For now, we have this we call camp management, which our staff monitor the needs of the people here in the evacuation center. We have this NIPA making, shingles making, which the beneficiary are the people who live in the evacuation center. We ask them if they want to make NIPA shingles, and then we provide the materials. We will pay for their labor.
Several other groups in and out of the country have extended their services from rescue and retrieval operations to distributing relief goods and cash. Other efforts are focusing on shelter and housing. Lawyer Abdu Sabur Sawadjaan Jr. is operations manager for an international foundation with an office in Davao City.
What we have now is Rebuild Mindanao. It is a campaign wherein Habitat for Humanity Philippines will help construct decent and resilient homes for the victims of Typhoon Pablo. We will be distributing shelter repair kits to those partially damaged houses. Those are roofings. We will supply them with corrugated sheets, nails, and hammers so that they can repair their own homes and in the hope that they will return to the normalcy of their lives.
Over 840,000 people are still displaced, including 700,000 whose livelihoods were destroyed by the typhoon. Survivors also need mental health services. Dr. Gail Ilagan is director of the Center of Psychological Extension and Research Services, or COPERS, at Ateneo de Davao University.
Sometimes it was psychological first aid if the community is ready for it. Sometimes it was critical incident stress debriefing if we're focusing on how the disaster affected a particular demographics, no? Like service providers, they have a different psychological reaction to the tasks that they face, like picking up dead bodies. For some, it was about grief counseling because they have lost members of their community. But more importantly, we have always been biased at supporting the psychological recovery of children.
Using the help of volunteer graduate students, Dr. Ilagan Center accompanied service providers following the typhoon to offer mental health support in some of the hardest hit areas like New Bataan in Compostela Valley, Baganga in Davao Oriental, and Caraga Region.
For communities really to become stronger, not only would they recover and recover with very little help from outside, but also for them to rearrange such that they become prepared for the next one. Because the world is changing, you've got this global climate change thing happening. It's not going to go away in the next decade or probably in the next generation. It's still going to be there. You've got more extreme events happening in the most unpredictable of places. So we have to capacitate them at the grassroots level.
As recovery and construction continue, many are showing signs of resilience. For high school teacher Maylene Cuesta, she says she's anxious to get back to her students.
I will continue encouraging them to dream for a better life, never to quit schooling. When I look at the mirror, my already ugly and scarred eyes could be discouraging. But what's important is I still have one eye left to persevere in life.
Following an appeal from the Philippine government and the United Nations for more aid, Australia pledged an additional $3 million. The funds are for emergency shelters, including improvements of existing shelter facilities in the worst hit areas. Funding will also go to emergency cash for work programs to help clear debris and provide critically needed income to workers across the affected areas. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Compostela Valley, Southern Philippines.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.